the AM and FM 107 Radio Network, broadcasting from AM and FM stations around the country. Welcome to the Small Business Administration award-winning School for Startups Radio, where we talk all things small business and entrepreneurship. Now, here is your host, the guy that believes anyone can be a successful entrepreneur, because entrepreneurship is not about creativity, risk, or passion, Jim Beach.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to another exciting edition of School for Startups Radio. I hope you're having a great day, having a great week, off to a great start, just reaching out and grasping life and saying, I'm going to have fun and do cool things in my life. And that's what it takes. You standing up and saying, I am going to be one of the interesting people in the world. Me, not you, me. And start doing interesting things. Some things we do just for the story. Some things we do just to learn from. Some things that we hate doing, we learn so that we learn to hate it better. We just got to go and do and try things. I'm so excited for a great week of shows and our show today. I've got a fantastic one. First up, we have Mark Silverman. We're going to talk about his leadership book. He has a new leadership philosophy. We will talk about it. We're also going to talk about introverted sales. You know, I'm a huge introvert. And so anytime we talk about that, I love it. And we will talk about Mark's specialty of turning high achievers into effective learners. I am very excited to welcome him. Another great example of niche marketing as well. So he is a very good guest, very interesting. And then we have welcoming back to the show, Rhea Wong to the show. She has been with us before talking about nonprofit fundraising, which is something that's interesting to me. My wife used to be a nonprofit fundraiser. They would have all of these balls, these galas, and people would show up and give money. And I would just sit there and go, how can you make money? This gala cost $1 million. How could it be profitable? So anyway, great to have her back. Plus, she has the world's greatest collection of glasses. So I'm excited to see what color she is wearing today. And as always, I can't let you forget, tomorrow is the official drop date for our book, The Real Environmentalist. Please go get your multiple copies today. It is so critical that we show good, strong pre-sales. So that when it drops tomorrow, we will have good ranking numbers. It is all about the formula, just with everything. It's all about the formula. So I appreciate you helping and supporting us. You know, we've done this show for 13 years now for free, and you've listened for 12 years, and it's time to go buy a book. Also, have you heard about this 3i Atlas thing? It is a comet coming toward Earth that has changed path, which means that it is under direction from someone. Very interesting. Anyway, great show. We're going to get started in just a second. Welcome back to the show. And again, thank you so very much for being with us. Very excited to introduce another great guest. Please welcome Mark J. Silverman to the show. Has had a very impressive career. He did the technology senior account executive and all that kind of thing, and then decided to become a coach in the last 13 years. Has had amazing success doing that. Has written three books. And all of them have a lot of reviews. You know, a fiction book can get 300, 400 reviews, but nonfiction, writing about leadership, you're lucky to get 20 or 30. His last book has 85 five-star reviews, which is really impressive. The book is called The Rising Leader Handbook, Turning High Achievers into Effective Leaders. Mark, welcome to the show. How are you doing?
Thank you so much for having me on your show. This is great.
After that introduction, is your ego stroked enough?
I feel really good about myself. I do. Thank you so much.
So for context, everybody, I insulted and hurt Mark's feelings right before we came on air. And so I'm having to suck up to him now to try to win him back. Mark, tell us about the book. I love it. It has a blurb there on the site This is the most thorough, transformative, and compelling book on leadership I've ever read. That's quite an accolade. Tell us about
that's
it.
My, that's Steve Chandler, who was my first coach all those years ago, who fired me and told me I shouldn't be a coach. So to have him read the book and tell me that I wrote not only a good book, but the best book, had me on the floor in tears, was really kind of fun. What it was I had been a coach for quite a while. And we were, coaches are always part of programs trying to figure out how to monetize what they do, how to codify what they do, how do we make exponential. And I wasn't really sure what I didn't want to do what I was doing before, which was my Omi Tens book, which was about how to get things done with ADHD. And a friend of mine basically said, why don't you write about what you actually do, which is work with senior leaders who've moved through the ranks really quickly and need leadership skills. So that's what I do all day, every day. I usually coach the uncoachable. So she put me in a room with a bunch of sticky notes and didn't let me out until I had 12 chapters and the four sections, which is leading up, becoming a trusted advisor, because I'm called mostly by CEOs who say, I've got this person, they're super talented, they're amazing. They're either bull in the china closet, or they won't let go of certain amounts of work to be able to move upstream, all that kind of stuff. So I teach them how to be trusted advisors to a CEO. Then the really hard thing in leadership is leading on a team of leaders. So if you're in the C-suite and you're working with other ambitious people who have their own agendas, who have their own personalities. How do you lead on a team of leaders? Stay strong and do the co-opetition of helping other people rise while shining yourself. Then there's always leading your team, and there's millions of books written about leading, your team. And then the most important thing to me is leading yourself. I use every interaction, every situation that comes up with leading up, leading your team, or leading across to how do you grow? How do you grow your capacity? How do you grow your nervous system? How do you become a more fulfilled human being who brings more to your team, to your family, and to the world?
Excellent. All right. So let's dive into each of them a little bit, please. Can we talk about leading up and teach us some of the core principles there?
So one of the things that people don't understand is often is the job of a CEO and the pressures of a CEO. Most CEOs I know are actually lovely people, but many of them, because of the stress and the strain, either seem erratic or indecisive or change their mind or change direction or authoritarian in different situations. And our personalities are to take a lot of that personally. So I teach my clients how to not take whatever's going on with their leader personally, to look for what's going on with them, look for behind the words, behind the attitude, behind the emotions, and how can they either turn down the temperature or get them clarity or help them make decisions faster. Leadership is so lonely, and CEOs don't have people to talk to. They either have yes people or people who are afraid of them, or they're just lonely and just don't have anybody to talk to. And if you can be that mature person in your CEO's life and become that trusted advisor, it's just a game changer.
Yeah, that would be the ultimate mentor or just relationship to have. How do you do that? How do you let that CEO know you want to be the trusted advisor, but not a yes man? How do I start that conversation? Not a conversation, but what are the steps? Do I just start sucking up, but also give a no every once?
I'm sorry.
All right, go ahead.
Sucking up is not the thing to do. Michael Bungay Stanier wrote a book called How to Work with Almost Anybody, and he calls it a keystone conversation. I call it a level set conversation. It's basically saying, learning, kind of having a bingo card and getting all of your slots filled in. What do they value? What do they fear? What are their triggers? What are they trying to accomplish? Learn your CEO as best as possible. Learn everything about them so that you can see where the puck is going to go. The next thing is learn how to disagree respectfully. Learn how to always come up with a solution if you disagree. Learn how to tell the truth. Always have your CEO's back. Never, ever, ever go to anybody on the team and talk behind your CEO's back. Always have those direct conversations with your CEO. If your CEO is volatile, learn what it is they need. So I do a lot of personality testing. When I do it, when I do Enneagram, if I know what the Enneagram of the CEO is, I can teach my clients, okay, so they're a controller. If they're losing their shit, they're feeling out of control, or they're an achiever. If they feel like they're failure, that's when they're going to be triggered. So every single person has a different kind of trigger. If you can figure out what that is, you can turn the temperature down so much faster and get to a solution faster.
All right, excellent. What about leading across? So leading a team of peers, this immediately makes me think of what I've heard about for SEAL training and the first nights of that SEAL Hell Week, how they find out or can predict who's going to make it through all the way, you know, to the end
right. of
the training. Leading across, tell us about that.
So the biggest pitfall and the biggest danger in leading on a team of other leaders is self-consciousness, is lack of self-worth, is worrying you don't measure up. So you have to have your own team of people, your own mentors, your own posse of people who can help you stay on an even keel. You need to do your own work so that you're grounded and centered more of the time. We're not always going to be grounded and centered, but the more you work that muscle, the better you can. Now, once you know that you know your worth to the organization, you know your worth as a human being, now you can start looking at your teammates and deciding what do they need? What, again, back to that bingo card, what does each one of your teammates care about? What does each one of them value? What's each one of them scared of? What's their triggers? What are they trying to accomplish in their lives and in their careers? And then go out and help them get there. You know, the biggest fear of helping all boats rise is that you won't get noticed. And 9 times out of 10, maybe 10 times out of 10, what is noticed is the person who is actually helping all the boats rise. You know, again, what I tell my clients often is, you know, do you want to get the promotion and everybody's gunning for you and have knives out for your back? Or do you want to get the promotion and have people say, you know, I wanted that too, but I'd still follow this person anywhere they go because they've always had my back. So it's basically that. It's making sure you're helping people get where they want to go. A lot of my clients go from second in command or on the C-suite to be being groomed to become the next CEO.
All right, leading your team. So leading those that report to you.
Again, that you know, there's a million books about that. I kind of simplify it for myself. Is, you know, you look at your team. What is the goal? Have you set? Are you the CEO of the team? Have you set the vision of your team's responsibility inside the organization? There's the organization vision. Now, what is your team vision? Are you getting everybody to row in the same direction? Are you checking to see what resources your people need? What training do they need? What gaps do they have? And are you holding them accountable? Are you being very clear on your feedback? Are you creating strong agreements rather than having just expectations that people will do stuff? Are you going to be explicit about that? And just clear communication, communication, communication.
All right. And finally, leading yourself.
Leading yourself. That's the hardest part, right? Again, the way I use it, you know, people told me to put leading yourself first in the book. And I was very much against that. For me, the we do all this internal work of why do you crumble when someone yells at you, when your CEO yells at you? Why do you crumble when you have a fight with someone on the team? What is that internal work you need to do in order to use every situation to find out how you can become a better, stronger, more grounded and centered human being? By the time we get to leading you, we've already done a bunch of that work. And now we can say, now what exercises, what practices, what do you need in your life to be your best? Like for me, I need to be in bed by 10 o'clock. That's my keystone habit of if I'm in bed by 10 o'clock, it means I'm going to be up by 5:15, which means I'm going to meditate and I'm going to journal and I'm going to exercise. If I go to bed any later, that just screws the whole thing up. So I know what one of my core things to be at my best is. And that we set that up for everybody. What do you need in relationship? What do you need with your spouse? What do you need with your kids? What is, you know, what are they looking for from you? So how do you become the most healthy, most vibrant person you can be? Because I know so many, the reason I'm a coach is because so many of my contemporaries had it all, but you know, the vacations, the houses, you know, the millions of dollars, and then the marriages fall apart, the mental health falls apart, addiction, all of that stuff, the health falls apart. And you know, why should you be 45, 50 years old and have everything fall apart around you after you've won at life? I think that's ridiculous. So that's why we do leading you.
All right. You alluded to it being a coach. How do you get selected to be a coach? How do you, why do you have the right to stand up and say, I coach, I'm smarter and better, and therefore I deserve to be the coach?
It's funny, when I first became a coach, I had lunch with a friend of mine, and he said, Silverman, who are you to become a coach? You're a mess. And he knew me when I was a mess. And I was really insulted. But then I thought about it. And in that conversation, I said, you know what? And this was years ago, before I've had so much training and so much experience and so much success. It was basically, I've been there, done that. I have had the lowest of lows. I was homeless. You know, I was absolutely at the bottom of the barrel, and I've triumphed. I've made millions. I've been successful. I've been in every situation, and I've been a student. You know, when my life crashed and burned, when I put my life back together, I've been a student of being human. How do you create a life? How do you create a human being? Because I created a new Mark J. Silverman. How do you create a person who is going to have impact in the world? How do you create yourself as a leader? How do you create yourself as a family person? And it's boded well so far. I've had a full practice for my whole career, and all of my clients tend to do really, really well.
How'd you get your first client?
My first client, when I left my really high paying job, to hang out my shingle as a coach, several of the C-suite executives that I sold to when I was in technology and worked with over the years said, you know, Mark, I don't know what coaching is, but you know, you always talk to me about my life, about my career, about who I was. So whatever coaching is in, I'm in. I just want to keep a relationship with you. So my first couple of clients were just old customers. And then the way I built my practice was I gave free sessions. I just coached anybody and everybody for free for a good 2 years. And some would end up working with me. Most wouldn't. You know, pretty soon it was a full practice, and I don't really do a lot of free coaching anymore. But that's actually still how I get my clients. I write books. I have my own. I have 800 episodes of my own podcast. I'm on other people's podcasts. I speak, but almost all my clients are referral based. I create stark raving fans out in the world that send people to me, and they know what my expertise is.
So do you do any marketing?
I do tons of marketing. I just don't know how much it works. I know when people hire me, they say, I went and looked and I saw your face all over social media. I saw your book, you know, your books on the bestseller list for the last 2 years. Like I heard you on a podcast. So they do see that. But my marketing is making sure that there's people in the world that know that if they send someone to me, they're going to get a thank you from that person. I make sure that people are like happy to send their folks my way, and they know who to send my way.
All right. How do you build that kind of network as you're building, you know, one of our listeners, as they're building their practice? How do they develop the network part?
Service.
Your magic sauce is.
And, you know, I was struggling as a coach for a while until I realized how I built my sales business. I'm an introvert. I'm shy. I don't like to bother people. My sales career was meteoric. And I did, the reason I found, someone once said to me, introverts make the best salespeople because they're interested in what the goals and what's happening with their customers. And that was the light bulb moment for me. People trust me, right? So I sold because these C-suite executives who are buying multi-million dollar complex systems trusted me and trusted the people I brought in. when I applied that to my coaching business, I just served people. I coached, I checked on people. I made sure, I did so much free coaching to people out in my communities, in networking groups that I was in, and just showed up so that it made sure that anybody who ever spoke the words Mark Silverman would say, oh my God, you should meet Mark Silverman. You've got to meet Mark Silverman. I just made sure that that was the way I was seen in the world. And it wasn't fake. It was, I really care about people. I really care that people succeed. I've watched too many people crash and burn, after being successful. So people know my heart's in the right place. And that's how I keep my business to this day.
Very, very well said. Would you say that you have a niche at all? Do you have only Fortune 500 C-levels?
Then a lot of them aren't Fortune 500, but they are larger companies. About a third of my clients are entrepreneurs of, maybe 25 million or less companies that have been me for a while back when I did that. But most of my clients are really generally young, 30s and 40s. Who have risen through the ranks really quickly and haven't matured their leadership skills to keep up with the level of responsibility. I'm usually called when someone says, this person has to be, I need them. They're a key person in the organization. They're just not getting the leadership part. How can you help? And is it, it's because they're in a bull in a china closet. They're creating havoc in the team. They're doing whatever it is they're doing. They're not speaking up in meetings. How can you help? And that's what I generally help with.
And is there three or four buckets of possible answers to that question? Do you find a pattern?
Well, unfortunately or unfortunately, pattern. The joke I say is most coaches say, I want to coach a Richard Branson. I want to coach people who are coachable and want to grow. And yeah, that's lovely. I've made an entire career of coaching the uncoachable. I've made an entire career of people coming onto a call with me and saying, look, I don't know what you just give me some tricks and hacks to improve my relationships or just give. And the resistant and I've turned them into long-term clients who wouldn't live life without me.
Very good. Excellent. Well, Mark, what's the next book on?
Oh my God. My publisher wants me to write an autobiography, a spiritual autobiography. I've been resisting that. So I don't know.
A history of your spiritual nature.
My spirit, my journey from alcoholic, drug addict, homeless guy to millionaire to coach to kind of a deeply spiritual guy is the story that she would like from me. I'm not sure I'm ready to tell it. So
you just did right then. And remember what we talked about of taking a audio file and going from there. There you go, there. Take that 30 seconds to turn that into a book.
Yeah, it's an interesting one. For me, when I help a lot of people get their books written, for me, a book shows up in my soul and says, you need to be written. You need to write this. And then it sits me down and I write it. So that hasn't happened yet.
Okay. Well, come back when it does. I'd love to hear that story in full. Mark, thank you so much for being with us. How do we find out more? Get in touch, get a copy of the book.
Everything is at markjsilverman.com, markjsilverman.com. Only Tens, my first book, is free on the website. You can get a hard copy or an electronic copy. I give that away for free. The Rising Leader is still on the charts, so I'm not giving it away until it falls off the charts. Then I'll give it away forever, but you can get that on Amazon. Oh, fantastic. And everything else, my podcast, all on my website.
Fantastic. Thanks for being with us, and we'd love to have you back.
This was fun. Thank you.
And we'll be right back.
Well, that's a wonderful question, actually, Jim.
Oh, my gosh. I love the opportunity to do this. Thank you, Jim.
Wow, that's a great one.
You know, that is a phenomenal question. That's a great question, and I don't have a great answer.
That's a great question.
Oh, that is such a loaded question.
And that's actually a really good question.
School for Startups Radio.
We are back, and again, thank you so very much for being with us. Very excited to welcome back to the show someone in a space I know a little bit about. Please welcome Rhea Wong to the show. She is dedicated to nonprofit leaders getting more money. Sometimes she acts as their coach. Sometimes she helps them raise the money herself, but she has an incredible background in raising money in the Silicon Valley for nonprofits. Rhea, welcome to the show. How are you doing today?
I'm well, Jim. Thank you so much. And actually, if I could correct Please. You a little bit, it's actually across the country and actually in some parts across the world, I've helped folks in Europe. So pretty exciting. Yeah, there's a lot of money out there for good work.
Yes, very impressive. Very cool. How'd you get started in that? That seems like a weird niche to end up
in. Well, you know what they say about entrepreneurs is that you solve your own problems. So I was actually an executive director of an educational nonprofit here in New York City. And I didn't know, Jim, I didn't know the first thing about fundraising. So I was this 26-year-old ED, literally did two Google searches. First Google search was, what does an ED do? And the second was, how do you fundraise? And unfortunately, I think a lot of people in our sector find themselves in this situation. So I just thought, why don't I create the business that I wish that I'd had to help me out when I was first starting out? So that's how it all happened.
Okay, well, that's the desire part, but how did you actually make that happen? So how did you start learning? You didn't have ChatGPT back then. So.
Oh, I wish I had. You know, to be honest, Jim, it was a lot of trial and error. Like, people learn a lot of things. I went to, you know, the webinars, and I would take meetings with people who would, you know, deign to take my phone call. And I'll tell you, I screwed up a lot. So I say to my students, you know, benefit from my mistakes. Make new and different mistakes. Don't make the same mistakes I made.
Yeah, those are all boring mistakes.
Yeah, we've been there, done that. Yeah, exactly right. We don't need to make those mistakes.
All right. So what did you do first? I mean, did you... let's actually talk about it after you left this ED and went out on your mm-hmm. own. And mm-hmm. became your own fundraiser full time.
Yeah.
Talk about that.
Well, I'll tell you, Jim, it's so funny. And I think a lot of entrepreneurs may... resonate with this, which is one, I left a job and I wasn't quite sure what the next thing was. And in fact, I took a job in tech and it took me about 2.5 months to realize it was not, well, that's not true. I knew in the first week it was not for me, but I stuck around for 2.5 months. And then what happened was I was kind of drifting. I was looking for my next job. And honestly, and I think a lot of entrepreneurs will resonate with this too. None of it just felt very interesting to me. And I realized that I'm just very ornery and I don't want a boss. And I don't like people telling me what to do. So having a job was probably not going to be on the table for me. And what happened was I kind of became an entrepreneur by accident. I started taking on projects for friends of mine. You know, I had some free time. One project led to the next. And before you knew it, I was an entrepreneur on my own doing consulting work. And then around... in the pandemic, I really decided to focus in on fundraising because that is the pain point that every nonprofit has. And as they say, the riches are in the niches, right? So I thought, well, I can do a lot of things, but the thing that I think I do particularly well, and the thing that I think people might pay me for is fundraising, and specifically major gift fundraising with individuals. So that's what I've done since then. And I think since we've last spoken, things have been really great. Business is booming. I mean, the fundraising environment has not gotten easier, which on the one hand is not great for the world at large, but on the other hand has been great for my business. So I'm grateful.
How do you raise money from a billionaire?
Yeah, well, it's a good question. Well, everyone wants to know that, right? The thing that I think a lot of people miscomprehend is that they think the next big donor is out there somewhere. But the reality is that for many nonprofits, their biggest donor is already in their database. They just don't know it yet. So I think everyone's out here trying to chase, you know, Mackenzie Scott or Oprah or, you know, the Gates money. And while that's all well and good, I think that there's a lot of wealth and capacity that you are not even aware of. So I think the first thing, and again, this is very much an entrepreneur thing, is you need to create a relationship with your audience. You need to understand what it is they are looking for. You need to not bore them with your emails. You need to engage them in hoping and dreaming of a better world together. And if you can do all those things, then you partner with them to create a philanthropic partnership. So every millionaire, every billionaire that I know of has always been thinking about, well, what's the next thing? I've made my money and I want to give back to the world in some way. I want legacy. I want to make my life have counted in some way. And so I think the best fundraisers are the ones who come up alongside these folks and say, what is it that you dream of and how can I help make that happen for you?
Yeah. What does a billionaire dream of? Do they dream of being famous and getting the accolades, or, you know, a lot of them, I think, do this anonymously.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think they're dreaming of?
Yeah, I mean, look, that's a hard question. Everyone has their own thing, right? But I think there's a misapprehension that, oh, every billionaire wants their name on buildings and they want to have the big galas and the sets. I mean, the truth is a lot of billionaires and multimillionaires that I know of are very low key. They're very, you know, they're like you and me. And frankly, a lot of them have made money and are really just thinking, how can I make the world better for my kids? How can I give back? How can I see some change that lives beyond me? And that's where philanthropy lies, because philanthropy is literally in its root form, love of humanity. And so how can we help these folks who have been blessed with capacity and resources to really love on humanity in the way that feels right to them?
All right. And then is that, it seems like on TV, there's always a cousin related that had that disease that you're raising money for now. And I discovered that the cousin is the link. And now I got his money because I talked about his cousin, you know?
I mean, it is. I think the thing that we need to remember is that there are 1.5 million nonprofits in the U.S. alone. And I think people think, well, you know, as soon as somebody hears about our cause, whether it's like saving the whales or saving the dogs or, you know, sending kids to college, of course they are going to want to donate. And I just don't think that's true. I mean, think about your own life, Jim. Do you give to every single nonprofit you've ever heard of?
You know, the last time I had money, I kind of set it up so I don't have to worry about it. And at this point, it's taken care of by people that I pay.
Right.
To
right.
Take it out of my hand so I don't even have to think about it.
Right. Well, I think that's wonderful that you can both be generous and not have to worry about it. I think that the key for a lot of nonprofits is thinking about what is the intersection of my cause and my donor's life story, right? Because there are 1,000,001 causes out there that I could give to that would be worthy. But what makes it relevant to me is how it pertains to my life and my life story. So for example, like I've decided that I really want to give to education. That's going to be my cause. I also like, you know, wildlife. I like dogs. So those are the things I'm going to focus on. And by really focusing in and cutting through the noise, I can be a little bit more strategic with my philanthropy. And so I think, honestly, a lot of folks have spent their careers making money and not a lot of them have really thought about how to give it away strategically. And so I think that's the role of a fundraiser, is in service to help people think about how they would like to give their money away in order to get the impact that they want in the world.
Right. Has the economy made it no difference whatsoever? You said you're busier than before, but are people stingier or where are we?
Yeah, that's an interesting question, Jim. What I'm actually finding is that at the top level of the economy, so, you know, I don't even need to talk about the 1%, but, you know, the top 10% of people in the world with resources are not necessarily impacted by the day-to-day concerns. Like, these are not the people who are worried about the price of eggs. These are people like you who have set aside money, who know that they want to be philanthropic and are really just looking for the right thing for them. Now, overall, I think we can say that in times of flux and times of crisis, people are thinking about pulling back. You know, certainly times are tough for a lot of folks, but I also think that a lot of people are generally very generous and want to be helpful. And so what we see is, ironically, for example, in during the pandemic, giving spiked, right? So on the one hand, you could say, oh, it's really tough and you know people are not going to want to give because of the situation that's happening and businesses are closing, et cetera, et cetera. But actually, it was a record year for giving. So I think we can't necessarily assume that people are not going to give even when times are tough because people generally want to help.
Does the gala still work?
Jim, such a question. It still works. It still works. I am thinking that it is going to be a tactic that is starting to be phased out for a couple of different reasons. I think people don't really want to go to galas anymore. They don't want the rubber chicken dinner. And frankly, I think what I see among donors is that they're really hungry for connection. They're really hungry for authentic conversations, which is really hard to do at, you know, a 1,000-person gala. Now, that being said, there are folks out here who make a lot of money, like Robin Hood here in New York City. I think the gala or the event fundraising should be one of the quivers in one of the arrows in your quiver, but it is not and should not be the only way you raise money. And so when we think about creating a portfolio that is diversified, we have to think about different types of strategies. So the gala could be one. A grant writing foundation stool could be another. Individual fundraising could be another. Corporate sponsorships could be another, right? So there are many ways that we build a portfolio that can withstand some turbulence because of, you know, let's say one revenue source goes down, well, we have a bunch of others we can depend on.
You hope.
Well, you'd hope, yeah. And I think the tricky thing for the sector, at least, is with the pullback of a lot of federal and state funding, a lot of folks have found themselves flat-footed because they were really depending on that one or two big federal grant coming in to fund their operations. And so a lot of them are having to scramble and backfill now. And unfortunately, I think it's the consequence of having not built a diversified portfolio from the beginning, which, you know, sometimes when, what do they say, when the tide goes out, you see who's naked?
Who's naked?
Yeah. Have you heard that term?
I've never heard that one before.
Oh, yeah. So when the tide goes out, you see who's not wearing any pants. Yeah.
Okay. I'll have to plan differently then for my next trip to the beach.
Well, listen, depending on where you are, you could be just fine.
Yes. With all the global warming and stuff. Are the charities competitive against each other? Do they fight against each other?
Jim, that's a really excellent question. I think that that is also a misperception because the truth is there's more than enough out here for all of us. And so when I think about competition, quote unquote, I really encourage my clients not to think of other nonprofits as their competitor. Actually, what's interesting is I think their competitor are banks. So a lot of these banks and these funds are setting up what they call donor advised funds. And I don't know if that's what you have, but donor advised funds are essentially where people can park money earmarked for charitable giving. And I forget the number, but there's something like $250 billion in donor advised funds right now. And frankly, a lot of banks and a lot of fund managers have a vested interest in not giving the money away because they get compensated based on assets under management. And so what I want folks to think about is like, it's not other nonprofits that are competing for dollars. It's the banks who want to keep that money parked.
Ooh, interesting.
Mm-hmm. And controversial take. I don't know if the banks may come after me.
Probably not that many banks to choose from, so it's probably pretty easy to guess who the bad person, the guilty parties are.
I don't think they're bad. I just think that the incentives are mismatched. So if you see, for example, you know, Charles Schwab's and the Fidelities and the Jewish Communal Funds and your community foundations, these are the folks who are really holding the assets and should be in the business of advising their clients on where and how to give their money. And unfortunately, when you have a mismatched incentive system, I think things are not necessarily as, you know, the flow is not as easy as you would hope it to be. But still in all, I think if folks are listening in the nonprofit field, other nonprofits are not your competition.
All right. Good to know. How do you get selected to run a particular fund or a particular party or a series of events or a campaign? Are you competing against other people, other event planners to get the jobs there? Is there competition at your level?
Oh, at my level? Well, I don't really do event fundraising, so that's not really...
No galas for you, yeah.
No galas for me. Look, there are certainly people in the field who do major gift fundraising as well. But to be honest, one, I think the market is big enough for all of us. And two, I have a very specific strategy that I teach. And I think my competition is different enough from my philosophical bend that if you meet one of them and that resonates for you, then we were probably not meant to be anyway. Sure. I guess in a strict sense, I do have competition, but I honestly think the market is so big that we haven't even begun to tap it. So I don't worry about it, frankly.
Okay. And what about the Harvards of the world, the people who quote unquote don't even need to raise money? How often do you have to raise money for those people?
Well, you know, Vaya con Dios, like I'm so glad that Harvard does what Harvard does. You know, people come to me when they are clear that they need a system and a strategy for fundraising. And so what I often see with potential clients is, you know, they've been successful. So I tend not to work with startups. I tend not to work with folks who are just, you know, rubbing their first two nickels together. I tend to work with folks that are in kind of a mid stage where they've been successful. Maybe they're raising, I don't know, million and a half a year. They've had a couple of big gifts, but they haven't really done it in a way that feels predictable or strategic. And so what I really help people do is create a system so that they can build a pipeline of matrix of potentials and that they can plan ahead. Because I mean, as you know, with entrepreneurship, cash is king, right? So if I don't know what's coming in the next quarter, the next fiscal, it's very hard for me to plan. And so that what I do is I put some structure and systems behind the thing that may already be happening organically, but I help people to make it happen on purpose.
Is it just you or do you have a team?
Well, it's just me full time, but I do have a number of folks that I employ kind of on consulting or W-9 basis. And so I have folks.
In today's world, those are real employees, aren't they?
Yeah, I suppose that's right. It's really, it's amazing this world that we live in, though. I mean, I have my VA lives in the Middle East. My sales center lives in Serbia. I've got someone working for me in Kansas City, one in Arizona. I'm about to hire someone else in the Philippines. It is a wild world out here, but I think this has just been such a minute of opportunity for entrepreneurs between AI and a distributed global workforce. It's like the tools are there. There's no reason not to.
Well, why isn't it happening?
It's a good question. Well, you tell me, Jim. You talk to entrepreneurs all the time. Why do you think there aren't more of us?
I don't know. I think entrepreneurship is on the down right now. It's something about the pandemic just made us more aware of risk, I think.
Huh. That's so interesting because historically, in times of economic downturn and recession, we see more entrepreneurs like the Airbnbs of the world usually get birthed during recession. So that's interesting that you say that.
Yeah, I don't think that's dropped off at all. I think the cool companies are still being birthed. I think there's just fewer of them right now.
Interesting.
I don't know. I think that I do think that we're more risk aware now. You know, with the world dying and all of us, you know, going to be taken over by Nazis and killed by dinosaurs, and then there's that 3i alpha thing coming in space to kill us all. I think people are just scareder than they used to be.
Yeah, this is interesting. Though I have to say, I do think that with the rise of AI, we're going to see a lot of entrepreneurs. And again, it could just be in like a little part of the internet that I hang out in, but I just see like these young kids, these 19-year-olds creating companies based on AI and ChatGPT, which it was so exciting. And actually, I sent a podcast episode to my 18-year-old nephews, and I was like, listen to this. I hope it sparks entrepreneurship in you, because look, these younger generations, they are digital natives. Like, technology to them is like breathing. Why shouldn't they make money off of it? So I don't know. I'm hopeful for the future of entrepreneurship, but you could be right that maybe we're a little bit more scared than we used to be.
Well, we're also in an AI bubble, though, for sure. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm getting requests for people wanting to come on the show to talk about their AI dog food system.
Right.
You know, their AI swimming pool additions. And, you know,
sure.
We've taken AI one step too far, I think.
Well, I think it's a moment where we're really experimenting with what the limits are. And I actually really enjoy the creativity, because look, are all of these ideas going to pan out? Probably not. But I appreciate the fact that we're in a moment where people are willing to step into innovation, where they're willing to experiment, where they're really willing to push the boundaries of this thing. And honestly, I don't know about you, but I think for me, there seems to be a little bit of a gap between the promise of AI and the reality of what it's actually delivering. But I think that gap will close very, very quickly. And so I'm excited to see the amount of opportunities AI will create, the wealth it will create. And, you know, frankly, I think it's an opportunity for folks who don't necessarily have a lot of revenue and resources to begin with to level the playing field.
Well, it'll be interesting to see if that happens. I don't know. I am very, very convinced that Sam Altman is a real-life James Bond villain.
Are you?
Yes.
I mean, he seems to be the best of the worst of them, so I don't know that I agree. I think the other day...
He's the best of the worst? Because I saw him interviewed by Tucker Carlson, and Tucker flat out said, you killed this guy.
Yeah, it was a first. I mean, I don't think that in the world of I mean, look, it just doesn't make sense that Sam Altman hired someone to kill anyone, partially because he's a billionaire and there are way cheaper and less risky ways for him to get what he wants, which is in the form of checks to elected officials. So I don't think that Sam Altman killed his employee, because it just doesn't make sense. I do think that there are checks that need to be put on a lot of these, you know, tech masters of the universe, like the Elon Musk and the Mark Zuckerbergs of the world. But, you know, in all of the tech bros, I think Sam is probably the best of the worst.
Really? Because then the rest of them are despicable, because he was horrible in this interview. I mean, he doubled down on all of the bads, you know, so I was really, really shocked that someone let him get on the air and say all that stuff.
Well, it is shocking that he would even go on Tucker Carlson. I did not see the interview, but I do think when we're, I mean, let's take Mark Zuckerberg as an example, and full caveat here, I'm not a tech person, so I'm just speaking from as an everyday citizen, but it just seems to me that, and again, maybe this is like a Gen X thing to say, but I think we were better as a society and as a country before social media. And oh, I think no social media has really just ramped up the outrage on both sides of the aisle. And, you know, I'll just give you an example. I took my two nephews to Europe this summer as a high school graduation present. They did not really mingle with other. I mean, when I was 18 years old in Europe, you couldn't keep me in the house. I would have been out meeting new friends. Well, I don't know, but you know, young people are not mingling the way that they used to. They're not talking to each other the way they used to. My one nephew sat in the Airbnb and, you know, watched YouTube for 2 hours in Madrid. I was like, it is Madrid. It is summer. You are young. What are you doing in this Airbnb with your middle-aged aunt on YouTube? Get out. Go and see the world. And yet this is how a lot of them operate. I mean, look, I have lots of opinions. It doesn't necessarily mean they're founded, but I am observing a lot in the young people that they're just not able to connect. They don't know how to have conversations. They're not hanging out with other young people. It's weird, Jim. I don't know. Is that something that you're observing?
Well, I have children in three different decades, I guess.
Wow.
Oh, I'm such an idiot. I have children all, you know, I'm a moron. And the youngest, or the 14-year-old, that's not the youngest, has a lot of friends that his entire relationship with them is online, you know, and they're still good friends. And it's working for them, you know. I want my children to have friends that they know and have met and stuff. And he has a mixture of both. And my 10-year-old is the same. They're just doing it differently. I also have a 30-year-old. And I have no idea how they make friends, but they do.
Yeah.
And it's just a whole different system.
Yeah, it is different, though. I do point to the data that shows that young men in particular are increasingly isolated. Yes, a lot of them don't have friends. They're not dating, you know, therefore, like, our birth rates aren't going to be going up. They're not seeing economic opportunity. And I think that's when they become susceptible to things like, you know, outrage. And like we saw that young man recently with Charlie Kirk, like, it's almost a playbook, like, isolated young men, no opportunities, feel, you know, outside of the economic system, and are also extremely online and get hyped up and outraged and radicalized with whatever platform they're on. And then they go and they commit horrible acts like that. So anyway, I just think that the answer is connection. I just think the answer is we have to spend more time with each other. We have to make more friends. We have to go out in real life. We have to learn how to negotiate relationships and have things be awkward sometimes and have things be hard, because that's being a human. And I think the more we isolate kids from the messiness of humanity, the more disconnected and lonely we're going to feel.
I agree. Totally. It's hard to watch and hard to participate in and hard to know, you know, even not dating, but just meeting people with, like, you know, I'm older than all the generations we've talked about. It's changed for us as well. Mm-hmm. And, you know, just the staples, the let's go out and have dinner together is decreasing. You know, are you doing less of that with your friends? Just going out?
You know, I am, though I try to make a concerted effort to do it. I mean, the other thing, I think living in New York City, it's interesting that a lot of the socializing happens around drinking and going to bars, and I stopped drinking 2 years ago. So now it's been an interesting challenge. Like, well, why don't we go for a walk, or let's go for lunch? So that's been an interesting shift. But yeah, I think, look, I think friendships take effort. And if you're not prioritizing, if you're not making the effort, if you're not reaching out and checking in on your friends, like, you can't expect that someone else is going to do that for you. And so actually, Jim, you've really inspired me. I'm going to reach out to a friend after this conversation and say hello. And
let's make the audience do it too. Let's all do
that. Just reach out to a friend and say hello. You know, I cop to occasionally looking at social media, and there was this trend going around, which I thought was lovely. It's a, where men would pick up the phones and call their friends just to say goodnight. It was so interesting because at the beginning, the friends were like, well, everything okay? It's like, yeah, I'm just calling to say goodnight. It was like, oh, goodnight, right? And just like that moment of human connection was so touching, especially, and I don't want to be stereotypical here, but I know men, I have two brothers, they don't pick up the phone just to say hi, right? They pick up the phone when they need something, or there's like something very specific they need to say, but it's never just to check in. And women do it all the time. So men, if you're out here listening, pick up the phone, call a friend just to say hello.
Rhea, how do we find out more about you? Follow you online, get in touch, get a copy of your book.
I am extremely online. So I have a book called Get That Money, Honey. You can get it on Amazon. My website is Rhea Wong, rheawong.com. And by the way, Jim, can I play the 10-minute, the 10-question game?
Yeah, but let's do it separately, okay?
Okay, sounds good.
All right, we are out of time, and we'll be back. No, we won't be back. We're out of time for today, but back tomorrow. Be safe, take care, and go make $1 million. Bye now.